So today is June. Today is June 11th, Monday, 2012. I'm sitting here with Joe. Joe, can you please tell me your full name? Where were you born? Where are you from?
My name is Joe Joseph Antonio Figueroa. I was born in Brooklyn, New York, Cumberland Hospital, and I'm from Brooklyn.
Which part of Brooklyn are you from? Which area? Because I know there are different neighborhoods.
I've stayed in different areas of Brooklyn, but the longest I've been in one area, I was in Brownsville, Brooklyn.
Tell me about yourself, about your upbringing.
Well, my background is Puerto Rican. My family, I'm like I maybe I think third or fourth generation. They immigrated from Puerto Rico about four generations ago. I don't know how long ago, but or what the exact year. But yeah, that's about it. I'm Puerto Rican. You said background. Tell me what. Let me see. I guess the first place they ended up at when they came to America from Puerto Rico was Bedford-Stuyvesant in Brooklyn. And then like a little bit of Bushwick and Williamsburg, and then East New York, like the last stop, I guess they all settled down in East New York, Brooklyn. And my mother and our tribe settled down in Brownsville.
Can you tell me what's your first memory? Your first memories?
My first memory of what?
Just as a child, like, can you think back to your very first memory?
One of my first memories was sitting in a hospital when I was like maybe about 4 or 5 years old from third degree burns. And we used to live in, like I said, we lived in Bushwick and Bedford-Stuyvesant. They had a lot of old brownstones and old buildings there that were there from the pre-war era and stuff like that, from the Depression era and everything. And our bathroom was located in the kitchen, and the bathroom door was next to the stove, and the door opens outwards. So me being a fat kid sitting in front of the stove, waiting for the chicken to get done, I guess my aunt was in the bathroom and she opened the door and hit me with the door, and I hit the stove and the hot water and all the grease and stuff fell on me.
Do you remember what you were thinking being four or
No,
five years old?
no.
You just remember being sitting there
Yeah, I just
and
remember just. I don't even remember that part. Like, I just remember just being in the hospital after. Like, sitting in the intensive care unit watching TV.
that's all you remember. You don't
That's.
remember. I guess that's a good thing.
Yeah.
Okay. You said that your family is you're fourth generation Puerto Rican here in Brooklyn. Brownsville, is it a predominantly Puerto Rican neighborhood or
No. Brownsville is a predominantly black neighborhood, actually. Bushwick is predominantly Hispanic, Puerto Rican. Williamsburg around that time was, predominantly mixed. It was like a Puerto Rican, Jewish, black neighborhood. So they came from those type of areas, but we moved to Brownsville. And I was like an early teen, preteen, and stuff like that. But it is predominantly African American.
how was it for you being a Puerto Rican kid moving to a predominantly African American neighborhood?
I wasn't the only, well, we weren't the only Puerto Rican family. There were a couple more in my neighborhood, in my projects. But, like, I guess, like, coming up, like, they were looked at as, like, punks and stuff like that. And they used to get picked on. I used to see a lot of Hispanic people, a lot of young boys around my age used to get picked on. And, like, I just made a promise to myself that that wasn't going to happen to me. I mean, as a matter of fact, it did happen to me a couple of times. I was bullied and stuff like that. But at the end of the day, my bullies became my best friends, and we just started just doing mischief together and stuff like that. But, you just got to stand up and do what you got to do.
How did that happen? How did like some of your enemies become your friends, or how did you decide to say, okay, I'm not going to be one of these kids that they...
Well, like I said, you know, I stood up to them, and, you know, a couple of fights later, you know, I'm cool in the gang. So, you know, everything was good after that, and they still continued to pick on whoever they wanted to pick on, black, Spanish, whoever they wanted to pick on, but I just knew they wasn't going to pick on me no more. So, you know, and then from then on, I just felt like me being the minority in the group, that I had to do everything extra. Like, I had to make extra noise and you know, do a lot of extra, do everything I did had to been extra, you know what I mean? Because I just wanted to make a name for myself and just show everybody that I wasn't that, you know, the guy that they could just pick on like that.
Okay. Can you tell me about, more about your family and your mother and just, like, your overall upbringing?
Let me see. My family was, we were kind of deep. Like, there were a lot of, there were a lot of people in my family. My grandmother, my mother's side was the more dark-skinned Puerto Ricans, and then my father's side was, like, the light-skinned, you know, white-looking Puerto Ricans. But, you know, obviously I was raised by my mother's side, so, you know, we heard a lot of stories about from me coming up and from them just coming to America or coming to Brooklyn. You know, like, my grandmother was dark-skinned. A lot of my, the majority of my aunts are light-skinned. My grandmother was dark-skinned, and my mother was dark-skinned. So a lot of things used to happen, like some of the black girls. Like, I just heard one story that one of the black girls had pulled my grandmother's hair or something like that, and none of the sisters ain't do nothing. But then my mother found out, and she's the blackest one out of all of them. And she was, you know, they were teenagers at the time. She went out there and approached the girls, and it was a big fight. Like, and they just was looking at her like, where did you come from? Like, that's, she was like, that's my mother. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But, you know, like, the, I mean, that's, you know, it was a lot of racial things going on back then. A lot of people doing things in Brooklyn. But my family, they was, you know, they was pretty big. I had a lot of uncles, a lot of aunts. A lot of my uncles were involved in gangs and stuff like that. The one gang in particular that I remember them being involved was a gang called the Dirty Ones. And they was, like, around Bushwick and Williamsburg area back then. They was, like, I wouldn't say biker gangs, but they were, like, dressed, like, with the MC boots and the leathers and the club jackets and the vests and stuff, leather vests and everything. And when they fought, they had big gang fights, and nobody used guns. It was sticks and chains and knives and bats and stuff like that. But that's the way my uncles and them was raised, and that's the way they was brought up. And, you know, other than that, that's the way they went on for a couple of years. They just was involved in the street more and more, involved in hustling, involved in drugs and stuff like that, and assaults and all type of other stuff. Eventually some of my aunts became involved, who was their sisters, and they became you know, they used to carry drugs for them and, you know, make sales here and there for them, but that didn't last too long though. Cause they stopped. They wasn't doing that for too long. My aunts weren't stupid.
Okay. I'm gonna go backtrack just a little bit, to your mother and grandmother being the dark skin one, like the darker skin, in the family. How was it for, do you remember how was it for them when just, you know, I guess being Puerto Rican and you have part of your family who's light-skinned and then you're in a black neighborhood, but then, like, black people are like, well, you're not black, but you kind of look like us, but you probably have, you know, curly hair, longer hair, or, you know, do you remember how it was for her in the neighborhood or just for that part side of your family?
She was good. She was at home. She was right at home. I mean, you know. Everybody, they're the same complexion as she is. And, you know, it's not like they're going to look at her differently, whether she's Puerto Rican or not. Mm-hmm. You know, they're the same, you know. She felt like she could just blend in, think she was the same skin color as everybody else in the neighborhood. Me, myself, like, me being just a lighter person, like, I used to get into more, you know, more things and stuff like that and probably get a little picked on a little bit more because I was light-skinned. I had a little brother who was 2 years younger than me, and he was darker than me. So he was rough. He was a rough boy. So, you know, he was good too, you know. They knew he was Puerto Rican too, but it was just something more different about him. He was darker, he was, you know, taller, he played ball, he was in the sports and all that type of stuff. So he blended in, you know, he was just good with them because that's what everybody was doing, playing sports and stuff like that. So he got into that. But, you know, with me, I just, you know, I had to find my own way. I had to make my own name and, you know, and do what I had to do to survive.
Now you talk about making your own name, doing what you had to do to survive. Can you tell me more about that?
Well, it's just, I don't know, like, it's just surviving in the streets. I mean, Brooklyn is rough. Brooklyn's one of the roughest boroughs there is. So, you know, you gotta do things, and it's either you're going to be a victim or you're going to be, you know, the person that's doing what they got to do to survive, you know. But, yeah, that's about it as far as that. That's the way I feel about situations because, you know, Brooklyn is low income. There's not really too many opportunities and stuff like that for young people coming up. There's not a lot of – well, back in my day, there were some people that can be looked to as role models and stuff like that. But nowadays there is none. It's not a lot of people doing positive things and being role models for – a lot of these young men and women to look up to.
Okay. Who would you say was your role model?
I had one positive role model. He was from my project. Well, aside from, I can't even say that because my uncles and my father was just the worst. But I had one positive role model, and it was his name was Staff, and he used to work in the in the community center in the projects, and he got murdered and stuff like that in the projects, and the neighborhood in general just took it real hard because he was well known and liked, you know. So but that was one of the, I guess that was one of the only positive role models I had. But you know, everybody else was just gangsters after that. It's just gangsters I looked up to, people just in the street guns, slinging guns and hustling and stuff like that. But but that's about it. I don't think I had any other positive role models.
How did it affect you? Like, do you remember what you were thinking when he, you know?
Well, we all was thinking the same thing. It was like, it don't pay to be a good guy, you know? It don't pay to be a nice guy. Like, nice guys finish last. Mm-hmm. And, you know, everybody took it as a learning experience or a lesson, and they took from it what they felt was a lesson to them, and they just kept on.
So that's how you took it. And you said that you, I guess the life, like the way your uncles lived and your father lived, that was glorified to you? Was that something you...
It wasn't glorified to me until I realized what they was into and what they was doing. I mean, as being, you know, a baby and a toddler and growing up, I didn't know what they was really into until I got older, and then I, you know, realized what it was, and then at that time when I got older, it was kind of glorified, you know. They did a lot of things, they blatant stuff, a lot of flamboyant stuff, you know, everything that comes with drugs and money and stuff like that and violence, you know, and it was kind of glorified to us. In addition to everything else we were seeing on TV and stuff like that, all the different shows. So, yeah, it was, kind of.
So, did you see your role model, you were like, okay, good guys finish last, and you see these other guys, they're getting what they want, mm-hmm. And, you know, did you say, okay, I'm going to do this, or which path did you go in, like, when you were coming up as a teenager?
Oh, man, I went the negative path.
Yeah. Tell me more about that, like, about that time being in Brownsville.
I'm going to try to say as much without implicating myself in things. And I don't know, I took the negative path. I mean, I went to I went to junior high school. I went to IS-55 in Ocean Hill, Brownsville. I graduated from there, and I went to Thomas Jefferson. And after my second year in the ninth grade, I dropped out. And I started attending the School of the Hard Knocks and just was in the street, you know, running around, hustling, and getting, learning lessons from older guys that was gangsters, you know, and was teaching us the game and stuff like that. So just running around the neighborhood and again I'm trying to make a name for myself and try to make examples of other people and stuff like that. But yeah, I chose that path and, you know, just now I'm here today. It made me the man I am today.
Chose that path. You dropped out of high school. How did your family take it, or your mother? You know,
they took it as they knew it was gonna happen because that first year or two in high school, I wasn't really doing too good, and I was cutting school, and it was just violent. Like I was going to Thomas Jefferson, which is the first impact school in New York City. I believe they was the first school to have a metal detector. The year that I went there, it was a double homicide on the second floor of the school, and I still remember hearing the gunshots and me being in typing class. So it was just the worst. Like, and we was from Brownsville, and the school was in East New York, and Brownsville and East New York didn't get along, and, you know, we was going back and forth with them. I was pretty good in East New York, though, because I had family in East New York, like I said earlier, and they was from the projects as well. So I was pretty good as far as with that, you know. I had a couple of altercations with, you know, other people from East New York, but not right there in the particular projects where my family was from. But it was just going back and forth, and it wasn't a positive environment, Thomas Jefferson. It was just the worst, like. It wasn't a positive environment. It was very negative. It was very dreary. People was always scheming on, you know, leaving school early or leaving after homeroom so they won't get a cutting card sent to their house and stuff like that. So, I dropped out, and that was that. I just started living the street life, and it was like my mother already knew, like it was building to that. So she already knew what was going to happen.
Did she try and do any interventions before that?
Yeah, she did. I was getting cutting cards to the house, and I used to get slapped and stuff like that. And, you know, and that be that. But ain't really much she was gonna do. She wasn't going to kill me or nothing, you know. So I continued to cut school until I finally dropped out. Like I said, the second year in the ninth grade, and like that first couple of months in those freshman classes again, I said I couldn't take no more. I'm not doing it, and I just, you know, and I just left.
And you mentioned that Thomas Jefferson was an impact school. What's an impact school?
And there's a list of impact schools that are known for violence and stuff like that, and known for like a high level of truancy, you know what I mean? Like people just not going to school and people fighting and cuts and stuff like that and gang fights. So, you know, in the majority of the time, a lot of the impact schools have metal detectors in them. You don't see that type of stuff in the school in like the suburbs and stuff like that. You don't see metal detectors like. And I work in school, so, but yeah, those are what impact schools are.
Okay. And then how can you tell me about, you know, how it was for you when you first dropped out of school, being on, you know, running the streets?
No, I just had to figure out what I was gonna do. I did a couple of odd jobs. I was working. I worked my first job was custodial maintenance in a health clinic in Brownsville. They was at 444 Hopkinson at first, and then they moved to Rockaway Avenue. So I was with them like off and on, like seasonal, like in the summertime and a couple of in some months throughout the year and stuff like that. But it wasn't nothing permanent. And I did some roofing for a little while, construction and stuff like that, but that wasn't permanent neither. So, you know, finally I just gave in. I just started hustling. I just started doing what my friends was doing, hustling, selling drugs in the projects. And that's what I did.
And you were the Puerto Rican kid amongst the black kids.
So, I kind of stuck out like a sore thumb. But, yeah.
So, tell me about that time when you, you know, when you kind of shifted over from doing odd jobs to doing what your friends were doing.
But just, like just being... Like I was down, but I wasn't like in the like in that inner circle of like the real G's, like the older dudes and stuff like that. But just hanging around and them seeing my face and them hearing things that I'm doing in the projects and stuff like that, you know, made them take a liking to me. And then I became a part of that inner circle, and I started doing things and moving and hustling and getting drugs from them, you know, and selling in projects, and we got guns and stuff like that. So, you know, we pretty good. So I felt kind of safe, and I felt like I had like some type of purpose. Like I was going to try to make some money to try to support my family and stuff like that.
Okay. At that point in time, because you mentioned, your mother, you know, she slapped you around a few times, and then you were like, there was nothing she could do. Were your parents still together, or
no?
Was it, okay, she was a single mother.
Yeah, my father left when maybe I don't even know how old I was, maybe eight, nine years old. And for the most part, I pretty much knew him though. Like he wasn't like not there, like or absent, like, okay. And it wasn't his choice. It was her, it's my mother's choice. She didn't want to be with him or around him, so, you know. But I think if it was his choice, he would have been involved in my life a little bit more than what he was. But, was that the question?
What was his reaction when you decided to...
Oh, he was already gone. What? Oh, him? He was already gone. There was nothing he could do. Like I said, he was only around till we was like 8.
Mm-hmm.
I was like 8 years old, and then after that, he was gone, and it was just... And I'm the oldest, so, you know, I'm the one that really had to develop the fastest and just to be the man of the family. I had to develop and experience things, you know, the fastest, and experience is the best teacher.
You said you were the oldest. How many other siblings did you have?
I have 3 brothers and 1 sister.
Okay. And how, when you were trying to gain the trust of the older guys, how do you remember what you were thinking and saying to yourself, okay, I'm going to make them trust me?
Nah, it wasn't nothing like that.
Okay.
A lot of times, a lot of the stuff that young people do, they do it subconsciously. Like, they don't really realize what they're doing until, you know, it's being done. They don't realize what they're getting themselves into. They just living life every day. So it's not like I had a backstreet plan, because they ain't have to mess with me. Like if they didn't want to hang, if they didn't accept me, I can go somewhere else. Like I could do what but I'm going to get some money or I'm going to do something. You know what I mean? But I was accepted by my peers, so that was good enough for me. Like, you know.
Was there ever a point when you were like, I'm in way over my head. What am I doing?
Not really. Because my friends was, like I said, my peers, my friends were doing the same thing I was doing and going through the same thing I was going through. And I watched them, you know what I mean? I see how they react to certain situations in life and stuff like that. And I was like, if they could do it, I could do it too.
Okay. When was the turning point for you during that time when you kind of had to change paths or make a...
Oh, it was years later. years, years down the line. I had to go. I went upstate for 7 years, and it was at that point, you know, I thought about what I was doing, but there's a lot of other things that happened when I was upstate that kind of directed me or put me on the path that I am right now. But would you like to hear about it?
When you say upstate, because some people might not know what it means, can you explain to them what upstate is?
Like, I was locked up. I was in New York State correctional facilities, at least 11 of them. They kept kicking me out of different jails, back and forth.
Any particular reason why?
Gang-related issues and stuff like that, security issues. They wanted to, you know, one jail they kicked me out of because they said I was a threat to the security of the facility, so they kicked me out. You got that? You got that?
So, okay, tell me more about that experience.
What? Which one?
Just about being...
Oh, what made me change my path?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know, like, I was upstate, and, before I went upstate, I was involved with gangs, and, one of the major gangs that I was involved in was the, UBN, United Blood Nation, the Blood Gang, and, it carried on with me when I was upstate. At that time, Bloods was, you know, the gang, the Blood Gang was starting to get big and stuff like that, and they were all over upstate New York in the jails and stuff like that. So, you know, I became involved with that, and every jail I went to, they gave me some type of leadership position. So, you know, because they seen the leadership skills, you know, that I had, and they seen that, you know, I could relate. They people could relate to me. The little homies could relate to me. The little other gang members that was following behind them and stuff like that. So other people that weren't in gang seen, you know, what was going on, and I was in a couple of prisons that were supermax facilities behind the wall. So it was a lot of political prisoners that I had met. It's a lot of celebrities, mafia guys, serial killers, people that slaughtered their whole family and cut people heads off and stuff like that. And they see me in the yard calling meetings, and you know, all the Bloods is listening to me and following my direction and stuff like that. And they seen what was going on. So one time, this one older guy, he was a Black Panther, he came to me and he was like, "Listen, young Blood, man, you got to stop having these meetings in the yard because you're making it hot," because they was out there gambling and, you know, they play poker for cigarettes and money and stuff like that. And they was like, "You got to stop, you know, you got to stop having these meetings in the yard, man. You're going to make it hot. It's hot out here. Y'all, you know, y'all wilding out, y'all Bloods," and da da da. So he was like, "You know what, man?" But he was like, "I respect you, man. And, you know, I'm feeling what you're doing, but you could be doing a whole lot of positive things with the gift that you got." So, you know, me and him got cool, and we used to meet in the yard sometime, and we used to spin the yard, walk around the yard like 100 times just talking. And he used to bring books out for me, a lot of revolutionary books and stuff like that, and political books, books on strategy, war strategy and stuff like that, because Black Panthers were into that type of stuff. And, you know, I took a liking to it, and I sucked it all in, and I educated myself. I got my high school diploma when I was upstate. I was a liaison, an inmate liaison. I was a teacher's aide. I did all type of stuff upstate. And that was pretty good for being a Blood member. And I got kicked out of so many jails and lost so many of them jobs. It's not even funny. But, you know, so my path slowly started changing, and I started being more aware of what was going on. Even though I was hundreds of miles away upstate, I was always aware of what was going on in society and in New York City. We used to get the newspaper stuff. I used to read the newspaper every day. And I seen what was going on with the gangs and stuff like that, and I always kept my ear to the street, and I didn't really like what was going on. So, you know, a couple of years later from being upstate, I had about 2 years left for me to go home, and my mother passed away. And when she passed away, they let me come down to the funeral and stuff like that, pay my respects. And I think that was like my turning point. I think that was my turning point when my mother passed away when I was upstate. I just was like, I'm not going to do it no more. Like, I felt like, at first I felt like before she passed, I just wanted to come home and just do things, just make her proud of me and stuff like that and be a good boy. But when she passed away, I just was like, I don't think, or I felt like I didn't have anything to come home to and stuff like that. But I had a pretty decent support system, you know, and a lot of guys up there, they experienced the same thing. They lost their mother while they was in jail, and, you know, some of them didn't even get the opportunity to go to the funeral and stuff like that. But that was my turning point, I think. I think that was my turning point. But I said, all right, I'm not doing it no more. I'm still going to come home. I'm still going to make her proud. I'm going to do something positive with myself. And I did. I came home December 2003. I went to school for human services. I had two internships with city government agencies. And from then on, I just, you know, began working with different populations under the human services umbrella.
Okay, and when you decided to, I'm just going to backtrack a little bit just to get a few questions that I have answered. You mentioned being part of the Blood, United Blood Gang. How was it being a Puerto Rican but leading this gang, and then they have like
that's a whole other story. Yeah, that's crazy.
And then I know they have other Latin
gangs.
Yeah, in the jail systems as
yeah.
well.
And they didn't like me for that.
How was it?
They felt like I betrayed them. Like, you know what I mean? Like, you know, I was a Blood, and at that time it was a big war between the Bloods and the Latin Kings, and there was another gang called the Nietas too, and They didn't like me. They wanted to kill me. They ain't like me at all. But you know, it is what it is. Like when you with a certain tribe and you're brought up with a certain tribe, I mean us just us period, we're all tribal people by nature. So whatever tribe you was brought up in and you accepted by that tribe, you're gonna be accepted as one of them, and that's who you are. You know what I mean? So you know, not saying that my tribe wasn't Puerto Rican, because my family, you know, they are Puerto Rican. But, like, you know, like I said, just when I moved to Brownsville, it was just Brownsville. It was just the projects. You know, I didn't have my family around anymore. My mother moved out of my grandmother's house, and we went off on our own and moved to Brownsville. So, but they didn't like me upstate for that, though. And even it was some Bloods that didn't like it either. It was some Bloods that had high position. Like, I didn't have no position. Like, I didn't have no position or nothing. I wasn't the, you know, I wasn't, like, a leader as far as, like, being the leader of a certain faction or a set of the Bloods. But they just knew that I had that in me. And every prison I went to, you know, they just took a liking to me. And they was like, listen, we want you to do this. We want you to, you know, to school homies, and we want you to help with this and this, that, and the third. So, you know, and that's what I did. And, you know, I became the leader in different jails and you know, just running different jails as far as Bloods and stuff like that. Like, they didn't have a leader in a certain jail that I went to. I would assume that position, and everybody would respect it. But a lot of the Hispanic gangs didn't like that. But it is what it is, though. Like, they couldn't do nothing to me.
Could you straddle both worlds? Like, you know, say, yeah, I'm part of this game, but I'm still, you know, I'm Puerto Rican, like you. You know, talking, we speak the same language. Spanish.
There was other Bloods like that. But let me go back to the guy. It was one situation. He was a Blood, and he didn't like me, and he didn't like Puerto Ricans. Period. He didn't like me. So he came to the jail. And it was like around a Y2K, like they had a Y2K lockdown. Like, remember, they thought all the lights was going to shut off and you know, for the year 2000 or whatever, when the ball dropped. But in the mix of all that, you know, one of the major leaders of the Bloods had left. He got his own set and stuff like that. So a guy that was under him had came in while he was going out. He was coming in. They did like a big draft and they mixed up a lot of jazz and stuff like that. So he came to the jail and, you know, he was saying that the jail was messed up and he didn't like the way things was running and he didn't like the way the Bloods was doing this, that, and the third and the way they was moving. So they, you know, the Bloods came to me and, you know, they was like, yo, this guy's down here. He's talking, da, 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 da. So I went out there. I met the dude. And I told him, listen, you saying the jail messed up, right? And he was like, yeah. And I was like, well, you know, your OG just left here like a couple of weeks ago. So if you saying that it's running messed up, then maybe he was the one that left it fucked up. Well, I don't know if I can curse, but he was the one that left it messed up. And he just looked at me and was like, he couldn't believe I said that. And then he just looked at me and was like, I could just tell. He just was like, little bastard. So it is what it is, you know. And he just had to respect that, you know. But even though he was there, he had an actual position. He was on papers as being, you know, a general, a five-star general. I was still the head of the committee and committee rules. And I was the head of the committee, so he can't just come in and just call shots without us voting on it. You know what I mean? And if he play around, he'll be the next one that be laying on the plate. You know what I mean? But he was an aggressive guy, though, so you would have to be like that with him. There wasn't no playing with them type of guys up there. But,
Did you guys ever come around to any, I don't know, mutual, like, agreement or understanding?
Not really. No.
You mentioned that, you know, when your mother moved out of your grandmother's house and your family stayed back in East New York, did you have other cousins who were in, let's say, Latin Kings or
No.
They get involved in anything?
No.
No, none of that. So there was no, like, family, like.
On my side of the family, I was the oldest.
Okay.
And I was blood. And it was understood there's nothing else other than that. Don't go against me. And nobody even touched the gang thing at all. Nobody else touched the gang thing after me.
So I guess that's a good thing in your eyes now.
Yeah, it kind of is like a good thing because it's like, you know, I paved the way and I lived it and I'm telling them that it's not, you know, what to do. And I ain't even really have to tell them that. Like, that's the way we was brought up. We was brought up to be men. Like, so, like, we stand on our own and we don't have a problem with saying no. So
how was it for you transitioning from the transitioning when you got out? What year was it when you went in? Because we didn't get that.
I got in. I caught the case in 1996, and I was on the run for 2 years, and then I got caught in 98. So from 1998 to 2000, and like February 1998 to like December 2003. When I came home, so I did 65 months and 217 days upstate.
Wow. You said you were on the run. Were you on the run here in New York, like just?
I had a case in another state. We were selling drugs at one another town in New York. We were selling drugs in Binghamton, and I had caught a case up there, and I got bailed out, and I ran on it. I never went back to court, so I jumped bail and stuff like that. So they were looking for me for like 2 years.
Okay. And they stuff. Found you in Brownsville.
No, they ain't found me in Brown. They found me in another town.
Oh, okay.
And when I got arrested, they ran my fingerprints, and they found out that I was on the run. Okay. So that's how I got all that time.
Okay, for being on the, for jumping bail.
For the crimes and jumping bail.
Okay. How was it for you when you were leaving, transitioning out of jail into, you know, when you got out, you said you started to change your ways, while you were in, when you met the Black Panther, older guy, how, you know, when you knew you were about to get out, how was that transition phase for you?
Well, I went upstate for drug cases, and I got caught up in the notorious Rockefeller drug law, in that bracket. So, you know, they changed a lot of the laws, which helped a lot of guys come home off of drug cases. But one thing that they did do was they made it mandatory for all drug cases to go through a some type of halfway house or program. Like, you have to go through a drug treatment program, mandatory, regardless if you were selling or using it. You had to go. So during like the end of my bid upstate, I went to a program called KSAT, and KSAT was like a therapeutic community, and it was a side of the jail that was secluded from everybody else and population. It wasn't like protected custody. It was an actual program where you had to make your bed every morning. You had to, everything had to be organized. Your socks, you had to have the 90-degree crease on the corner of your bed, and you had to use the buffer machine and buff the floors until you could see a reflection in the floor and stuff like that. So from there, they had like this thing where they transitioned the guys from that type of environment, that therapeutic community, into one out in the street. So now we're still state property, but they have us in like a halfway house, and the one that they had a contract with at the time was the Phoenix House. And from what I understand, the Phoenix House is one of the best drug treatment programs and therapeutic communities there is in America. So they sent me there. I went to one in the Bronx. And I'm from Brooklyn, so, you know, that was the worst. They had me all the way in the Bronx, a building full of guys from jail. We had to sit in there for about 45 days before we was allowed to go out and look for a job or go on, you know, overnights and furlough, weekend passes and stuff like that. And what was so crazy about it is that when I was doing the transitioning phase, like, a lot of the guys that were in there were Hispanic, because, you know, they sold a lot of drugs, and you had a lot of Dominicans in there, a lot of Spanish people from Harlem and the Bronx and stuff like that, that dealt in heavy drugs. So the majority of them was in there, and then we're in the Bronx, which is predominantly Hispanic. And then, you know, we were there, and I'm Hispanic, but at that time, like, you know, I was kind of tight on my Spanish a little bit. Like, I tightened up my Spanish because I didn't really speak Spanish too much. But, you know, a lot of them guys were cool with me. They had a lot of love for me and stuff like that. So, you know, it was a respect thing. Like, they knew that I was Hispanic, but I don't rock with y'all. Like, you know, these my peoples over here. I'm from Brownsville. And or from Brooklyn, period. So they had this one counselor. He was my counselor. He was a senior counselor. He was taking money from the majority of the Spanish guys in there. A lot of these Spanish guys, they have families and stuff like that. So he would give them, he would do $20. Like, you had to pay him $20 under the table to, you know, because remember what I said, you got to stay there for 45 days. But a lot of those guys was getting overnights within the week, within 2 weeks, they was getting overnights because they were paying, not overnights, they were getting passes to go see their family. And they was paying them under the table, and the counselor was Hispanic, and all of them was Spanish. And, you know, the black dudes in there, my homies, they just was like, yo, we not stupid. We see what's going on. You know what I mean? And one morning I went, and I got on the line. Like, it was a line every morning, like Sunday or Saturday. And he would give, for $20, he would give them 11 to 11 or 10 to 10. Or, you know what I mean? 10 in the morning to 10 at night, you just got to come in. Nothing over 11 o'clock in the evening. Everybody had to be in the building by 11. But so I got in the line. I wanted to know what was going on. I got on the line, and I knew what was going on, and I went in there, and he was my counselor. And I spoke to him, and I was like, yo, I want to go home. You know what I'm saying? Like, I want to go home too. So he said, all right. He was like, how much you got? I don't even think he asked me how much I got. I think he assumed that I knew already. You know what I mean? So I was like, all right, cool. He gave me a time. I guess he said 10 to 10 or 11 to 11. I ran upstairs, got dressed. All my friends was like, hey, what the hell going on? Where you going? Like, I'll be back later. Went home, whatever. Went all the way to Brooklyn. It was like an hour and a half ride on the train. It was cooling and stuff like that. I had a girlfriend at that time. She had a car, so she'll drive me back sometimes to the Bronx. And the next week, you know, I came back and I let everybody know what was going on and stuff like that, but everybody knew, and I had to go down there and advocate for them because they wanted to start. A lot of them want to go home, too, and they got money, too. You know what I mean? So I went down there, and I spoke to the counselor, and I was like, yo, you know this ain't legal, and you think people stupid. They know what's going on, but on top of that, you're only doing it for the Spanish people. So how long you think this going to last before one of them guys tell on you? You know what I mean? And he was like, he looked at me. He was like, yo, you right. He was like, bring me a list. So I went upstairs. I got a list, you know, and I just was dealing with people that I knew wasn't going to be stupid and mess it up and come home late or come back to the building late. So I got a list. I came. I brought it down. He scratched out the ones that he didn't want. And I was just two young boys. They was from Brownsville, and we was tight because we was upstate together. We came from the program and then came down. We was real tight. He didn't want them to go. They was the youngest ones in there. He didn't want them to go. And I was like, listen. I said, these are my guys. They live in my neighborhood. One of them live like two blocks away from me. I got them. I'm going to make sure they be back. And he was like, all right, man. So, you know, took them down. I let them run around, do what they did. We met up at the train. Matter of fact, yeah, we met up at the train station, and we all went back up together. So I made sure, and then from then on, it was cool. They, you know, they can go out and stuff like that. But that's some of the stuff that was going on up there. So, yeah.
To Brooklyn, traveling back and forth. And you said that your Spanish got better. So I'm assuming growing up, you didn't speak Spanish very much in the house.
Nah, they actually, my grandmother had told me I used to speak fluent Spanish as a child. But then as I got older, I didn't really have too much use for it living in Brownsville. My mother spoke Spanish to me, and unfortunately the majority of the stuff she used to say was curse words, but, you know, she spoke Spanish pretty good. But I didn't really have too much use for it besides Spanish class in high school.
Okay.
But I got a little better as time went on, as I was being upstate. And again, that's a tool, like, that opens doors as well, you know what I mean? Like, knowing another language, it opens doors, so.
Now, how was your experience going from the Phoenix house back to when you moved back to Brooklyn? How was that transition from the Phoenix house, now coming, like, to Brooklyn, not being part of a program, just doing, you know, getting a job? You said you went to school for human resources. Was this
while human services?
Human services. Was this mm-hmm. while you were upstate or when you got out?
When I got out, I went to school. There was a program called VESET. And I went for orientation, and I was going to learn the requirements of VESET. VESET is a program funded by the Board of Education for people with physical and mental disabilities, and they send them to school, and they pay a portion of, you know, their school, or they'll pay all of it. So I went there. They sent me to School for Human Services, and I graduated. I had the best internship in my class, and I had, from that one internship, I had another internship at the mayor's office, and from then on, it was just building my portfolio and meeting people, you know.
What made you go in the route of human services?
My family is like, on my father's side, they're like teachers, and some people on my mother's side too. Some of my aunts, they're teachers, they're care providers and stuff like that. So I think it's in my blood to help people, you know.
It's only natural. And then you said, mm-hmm. from your experience, you had like leadership experience, just mm-hmm. like natural leadership skills. Mm-hmm. And I know that now today, are you still in the Brownsville area, or where are you in Brooklyn right now?
In Crown Heights.
In Crown Heights.
Mm-hmm.
And how would you say Crown Heights is similar or different to Brownsville from when you were growing up? And
Crown Heights is it's the same. It's the same. It's a mixture of a little bit of everything. You got Jewish people, you got a lot of Caribbean people, you got Hispanic people. It's a mixture of everything. You got white people. Nowadays, Brooklyn is going through the gentrification process. So, you know, you're starting to see a lot of white people in certain areas where you wouldn't normally see them.
Do you keep in contact with any of the people who, like, when you were growing up, some of your friends who used to get into trouble with or being mischievous, did they go through the same experiences as you?
As far as with prison? And yeah, some of them. I don't think they did. I mean, the ones that was around my age, I don't think they did as much time as me. And I think they did a lot of time, but not in one shot. Like, they would do what we call skid bids. It's like 1 year, 2 years, 8 months, 9 months. Well, all that add up, though.
In and out, adding up. Do you ever try and, for some of them who kind of probably don't do exactly the same thing as they did when they were younger, but did you ever try and say, look, you need to go a different route? You know, what are you doing?
No.
Do you ever try to change them?
No, they're grown men.
Okay. So you think that they're grown men and they don't need...
I mean, I would think that, I mean, I like to lead by example. You know what I mean? Sometimes I don't like to lecture people. You know what I mean? Even though I want to, but a lot of times I just lead by example. Like, you know, you do what you do, I do what I do, and just live life.
And now today, I know you do stuff with, you know, teenagers. Mm-hmm. And do you ever try and say, look, I've been there, done that, and you see some of them are like, man, that was me when I was young?
Yeah, those are the people I do lecture, but they're not grown. They're still kids, and, you know, they're easily influenced by different things, you know, negative or positive. But I do motivational speaking with them. I do gang intervention and prevention. I do mediations. I do family mediations between kids and family. Families, between their families. But, what's your question?
That was my question. You know, what do you do with them? Do you think if you had some of these services when you were growing up, it would have been different for you, or?
Yeah, probably. Like I said, there weren't a lot of resources, there weren't a lot of role models. And there weren't a lot of opportunities. There weren't a lot of job opportunities. So it probably would have been different if I had a little bit more help. You know, if we had a little bit more help, our young people.
And now as an adult, older in years, do you still straddle the African-American community and Puerto Rican community? Is it still the same, or is it just non-existent now that you're an adult, as it was like when you were in jail or when you were with the gang?
Well, those separations, they, you know, they still exist, but I don't acknowledge those things no more, because I think that's something real, like, it's not even nothing to really acknowledge. Like, we're all the same. Like I said, we're all tribal people. And coming up, I did a lot of studying and a lot of, you know, reading up on things and stuff like that. But we all come from the same background. We all got the same background as far as, you know, Africa being like one of the first civilizations and what was going on with slavery and how they was taking different people to different areas and stuff like that. And just what happens in Puerto Rico at one time, it was more Africans on that island than it was anything, you know, than it was Indians. At the time, it was inhabited by Indians. But it's the same, you know, we all tribal people. It was the same tribe to me, you know. So I don't really acknowledge it, but it does happen, and people still live by those type of ways of thinking about race and racism and culturism and all that. But this does happen. It still happens, though.
Okay. Do you feel, does it frustrate you sometimes because people like, especially with society, they like to put people in a box? You either have to go, oh, yeah, you either, you know, you have to feel like you have to belong to a certain group. You have to fit into a box.
Yeah, but that's natural, though, because, you know, everybody wants to be a part of something. You know what I mean? Everybody wants to identify with something. When you in school, people identify with different fraternities and sororities and stuff like that. So, you know, when you're in the street, people identify with the gangs, the crews in the street.
Wanted to add, just to wrap up this interview today on June 11th, 2012?
I don't know. I just, you know, I love Brooklyn. I love Brooklyn. I've been here all my life. I was born in Cumberland Hospital in the Fort Greene area.
Is Cumberland Hospital still there?
They rebuilt it.
What is it called today?
It's called Cumberland still. Mm-hmm. Okay. It's called Cumberland. It's in the Fort Greene area, I believe, Clinton Hills area. You know, I'm a Brooklynite. You know, I'm going to be here forever.
All right, then. Thank you.